Tonight on PBS News Weekend, the latest from Jacksonville, Florida, where a gunman killed three black people in a racially motivated attack. Then new research reveals a genetic variation that increases the risk of Parkinson's disease in people of African descent. And as a rice shortage sends prices soaring, a look at the effects of climate change on the global food supply.
Climate change isn't just a negative blanket of adverse impacts. There will be winners and losers.
Good evening, I'm John Yang. As Americans mark the 60th anniversary of Martin Luther King Jr.'s I Have a Dream speech, yesterday's fatal shooting of three black people by a white gunman in Jacksonville, Florida, is a brutal reminder that race-based hate is still among us. Authorities say the shooter, who turned one of his guns on himself, left behind writings detailing his ideology of hate. And the FBI says it's investigating the rampage as a hate crime. Late today, President Biden said in a statement, "Hate must have no safe harbor. Silence is complicity, and we must not remain silent." Our report is from Allie Rogan, and we should warn you, some of the images may be disturbing.
In the Newtown area of Jacksonville, neighbors gathered to lift each other up and grieve.
Our community is sick and tired of being sick and tired.
Authorities today named the gunman as Ryan Christopher Palmetto. The shooting began Saturday afternoon at a Dollar General store. The gunman killed two men and one woman, all of whom were black. After his killing spree, the shooter texted his father, telling him to check his computer, where he had left multiple racist manifestos, a suicide note, and a will. Police then entered the store and heard a single shot. The shooter was later confirmed to have killed himself.
I urge us all not to look for sense in a senseless act of violence. There's no reason or explanation that we'll ever account for the shooter's decisions and actions. His sickening ideology is not representative of the values of this Jacksonville community that we all love so much.
Florida Governor Ron DeSantis condemned the shooter.
Perpetrating violence of this kind is unacceptable, and targeting people due to their race has no place in the state of Florida.
The Jacksonville Sheriff's Office released disturbing photos of the guns the shooter used, a handgun and an AR-style rifle with swastikas on it. The latest federal statistics show reported hate crimes on the rise. Racism against black people accounts for half of all racially motivated hate crimes. Saturday's shooting was the latest in a series of racist attacks. Last year, a gunman targeting black people left 10 dead at a supermarket in Buffalo, New York. In 2021, a shooter killed 8 people, including 6 Asian American women, in Atlanta. For PBS News Weekend, I'm Allie Rogan.
More tragedy, this time in the military. The crash of a U.S. Marine Corps aircraft in Australia this morning has left 3 Marines dead. The Osprey, with 23 Marines aboard, went down on Melville Island off the northern coast, during a multinational training exercise. Everyone on board was injured, at least 5 of them critically. The cause of the crash is unknown, and the military exercise has been put on hold. A new tropical storm system, Idalia, has formed in the waters off Mexico's Yucatan Peninsula. Right now, it's more or less stationary, but forecasters expect that on Monday, it will start heading toward Florida. It could deliver heavy rain and winds to the Tampa area by Tuesday and make landfall as a Category 1 hurricane by Wednesday. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis has declared a state of emergency for more than 30 counties. Russia's intelligence services has confirmed that, as suspected, Yevgeny Prigozhin died in Wednesday's plane crash north of Moscow. U.S. intelligence officials say his plane was likely brought down intentionally, though not by a missile. The Kremlin has denied any involvement. Prigozhin led a brief mutiny against Vladimir Putin in late June. And hundreds of monster hunters converged on Scotland's Loch Ness this weekend in search of signs of the mythical Loch Ness monster. It's the biggest hunt for Nessie in more than 50 years. Volunteers and researchers were armed with thermal imaging drones, infrared cameras, and underwater microphones. Nessie enthusiasts who couldn't make it could watch live streams from the team's webcams. Still to come on PBS News Weekend, the ways climate change is disrupting the global food supply, and how American sunscreen stacks up against the rest of the world.
This is PBS News Weekend. from WETA Studios in Washington, home of the PBS NewsHour, weeknights on PBS.
1 million Americans are living with Parkinson's disease, a progressive condition that causes problems with body movement. And every year, about 90,000 Americans are newly diagnosed. But studies show that Black patients are far less likely than others to be diagnosed. And when they are diagnosed, it's an average of 4 years later than white patients. New research by a group of Nigerian, British, and U.S. doctors has identified a genetic variant that increases the risk of Parkinson's in people of African descent. And that variant is not seen in those of European ancestry. Ekemene Riley is the managing director of Aligning Science Across Parkinson's, which coordinated the project's researchers. Dr. Riley, from your perspective, what is the significance of this research, not only for our understanding of Parkinson's, but also for these underserved communities like people in America of African descent?
I think that it showcases the importance of inclusion and this real intentional inclusion of people that are traditionally underrepresented in research here in the U.S. and also abroad. And I think what we've done through ASAP, the Aligning Science Across Parkinson's, as you mentioned up top, and the program under our umbrella that has really moved this forward, the Global Parkinson's Genetics Program, what they have really done is been inclusive through by creating a global coalition of investigators to really be able to enable this work.
And I know that the mechanism, how this variant works, is not known, but it's a marker. Could this someday lead to targeted treatments, targeted therapies for people of African descent?
That is the hope. So there are Parkinson's therapies that are already in human testing that target GBA1, which is the gene in which a new variant was identified. And this gene has already been known to increase the risk for developing Parkinson's disease in people of other ancestries. And with this discovery and more like it, and being that we are already headed into an era of more targeted treatment, it really is the hope that it will widen the aperture and include more variants and therefore more people who may be affected. I think one major corollary here is the cancer field where, you know, if you have a cancer and you get it genotyped, there can be a particular treatment that is specific to what your cancer expresses, and a physician may be able to prescribe that for the patient. That is really the hope that we can get there to that place with Parkinson's disease. And I would say, you know, really we are there are about a few other risk factors in Parkinson's disease for which clinical trials are being run and targeting those risk factors. And so now knowing about this particular risk factor, we can really start to fuel more research into this area. And, you know, again, has the potential to revolutionize treatment options for underserved populations.
And you talked about earlier, you talked about the importance of inclusion. Is this an issue just for Parkinson's research, or is this an issue for medical research overall?
This is an issue for medical research overall. I think there needs to be far more emphasis placed in making sure that the research that's being done is reflective of the communities that we're in. It's not special. It's not specific to Parkinson's disease or any other particular disease area. And I think we're, you know, really moving in that direction. There are other studies that are being supported by the NIH. So key example is the All of Us initiative that's really trying to count more and more people within the U.S. that are of diverse ancestries and backgrounds. So we need more types of studies like that and for existing studies to really go out into the communities that they are serving.
Why is it that so much of medical research is about people of European descent?
There's a history of racism, scientific distrust within this country. There's also that type of history abroad as well. And I think as we are moving forward to think about how we want to understand disease and how we want to target disease, more and more we are going to see, well, what I hope we'll see, is more and more efforts really opening up and thinking about how to include populations of other ethnicities, of other ancestries, and really coming together to give a more global picture of disease. Like I mentioned, there are compound issues here, I think far more than we can get into in this particular segment. But I do think that it's time now to sort of shift our focus and really think about how we're going to dismantle what has existed before. Again, that being a history of racism, which has then, you know, fostered scientific distrust and the like, to really build now more and do better and include people who are traditionally underrepresented here in the U.S. and abroad.
I understand that this study, this your finding was sort of almost accidental. You didn't set out to look for this.
Right. That is correct. Originally, we set up this project and the leadership of GP2, you know, again, they are really walking the walk and thinking about how they're going to build capacity within the countries that they're working with and then also be a discovery engine. And so they set up a practice project for trainees in Nigeria and in Britain. And it just so happened that, you know, doing this training exercise and using real data, we actually led to uncovering a real finding.
And so that must have been very exciting for the people who were
in
training.
Very exciting for us. Yeah. Yes.
Akemini Riley of Aligning Science Across Parkinson's, thank you very much.
Thank you.
This summer, the effects of climate change have been hard to miss across North America and Europe. Record heat, wildfires, and warming oceans. There are other less obvious consequences. Rising greenhouse gases, warmer weather, and changes in precipitation all affect both the quantity and quality of food crops. Earlier, I spoke with Jonas Jagermeier, a climate change scientist at Columbia University and the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies. I asked him to explain the relationship between climate change and the global food supply.
If you're asking for the main drivers, factors that really affect crop growth in the field, then it's mainly three aspects. It's temperature, it's precipitation, and then something that's much less known is carbon dioxide, CO2 in the air. You know, and temperature and precipitation, they create extreme events such as droughts, heat waves, and then hail and flooding is a big problem in agriculture too. But the CO2 effect, it creates climate change, if you will. At the same time, crops love it. The plant growth is stimulated by CO2. At the same time, it creates adverse effects through all these cascading effects of climate change.
Does this affect all crops the same?
That's a very good question. Some crops are very sensitive to that CO2 effect. Other crops are not. So, and for example, corn, maize, doesn't really benefit from higher CO2 levels. So the full brunt of temperature and shifting precipitation patterns are felt in maize growing. So globally aggregated, corn is really seeing the largest negative impact.
So it sounds like there are winners and losers in terms of crops and in terms of regions.
I think that's a message that we need to get comfortable with conveying, that climate change isn't just a negative blanket of adverse impacts, but we want to be really careful because potential positive or potential gains are difficult to realize. And what's important is to think of the regions where they could happen. So in low latitudes, generally we're speaking of lower income countries, smallholder farming, that have much less capacity to adapt. So larger negative impacts will directly impact livelihoods and the food system in general. Whereas in, you know, developed breadbasket regions in the global north, there's more adaptation capacity that can buffer some of these negative impacts.
And this can also affect the nutrients, the nutritional value of crops. Is that right?
Correct. When I say CO2 is beneficial for plant growth and development, at the same time, it dilutes the nutritional content of crops. So it moderates any gains you may see from higher CO2 levels, and the nutritional quality, the protein content, micronutrients such as zinc and vitamins and iron, these components aren't taken up, aren't produced by the crop at the same pace they are growing. So it's a dilution effect. It lowers the nutritional quality of the crop, which raises concern for global nutrition. Put this all together for us and tell us the practical effects of all of what you've just explained in terms of people's diets, in terms of food insecurity in nations and in places that are already experiencing food insecurity. What are the practical effects of all this?
We have to get comfortable with the idea that agriculture is facing a new climatic realities and has to undergo a fundamental transformation. There will be winners and losers. Some regions may potentially benefit from moderate warming and higher CO2 levels. Vast majority of global breadbaskets will see adverse impacts, and there needs to be a proactive and long-planned adaptation implementation. That's the key to making global food systems sustainable and climate resilient.
Adaptation, what needs to be adapted?
The farmer in the field, first of all, can do intuitive things, such as shifting your planting dates, right? If it's warmer, you just go out earlier. And that's already happening. We see that. You have to think of new varieties, new cultivars, that, and that's a challenge for breeders, to develop these new varieties that are adapted to these new climate realities, that are late maturing, they're exploiting a warmer environment. But it's unclear at the forefront of research how far that can go. And then, you know, later you can switch to new crops altogether in regions where you say it's not viable to grow corn anymore. We as consumers play a big role in this. First of all, with the choice of what we're eating, we can make a whole contribution to the global sustainability of the food system by requesting more sustainable foods. For example, this is a sticky topic, but the animal-based contribution to your diet makes a big contribution to our footprint.
Climate scientist Jonas Jagermeier from Columbia University and NASA, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
The Skin Cancer Foundation says that to lower the risk of skin cancer, everybody older than 6 months should use sunscreen every day, not just when lying on a beach or jogging in the midday sun. But Ali Rogan is back to tell us that today's sunblock in America is full of ingredients that are decades old and increasingly obsolete.
The last time the Food and Drug Administration approved any new active ingredients for sunscreen that helped to block our skin from ultraviolet rays was 1999. In the past few years, some new laws have sought to expedite the regulatory process for sunscreen, but many consumers, industry leaders, and dermatologists are frustrated by the slow pace. On social media, skincare influencers and everyday users are spotlighting just how far behind they feel American sunscreens are. It's even got the attention of New York Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
U.S. sunscreens are far behind the rest of the world. I was in South Korea earlier this year, and it is so clear how far advanced the rest of the world is on sunscreen.
Here to discuss the state of American sunscreen is Dr. Rita Linkner, a board-certified dermatologist. Dr. Linkner, thank you so much for joining us. We just heard Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez talking about how far superior brands in South Korea, but also, of course, in Europe and other parts of the developed world. Why is it that American sunscreens are so far behind?
So you hit the nail on the head. It's been since 1999 that a new UV filter has been approved here in the United States. And to back up a little bit, what is a UV filter? So it's actually the chemical ingredient in the sunscreen, which is protecting our skin from UV light. And just to look at the sheer numbers globally, they're just much larger pool of options that manufacturers can draw from, which helps the consumer because there are just more products out there that protect a wider range of UV light. In Europe, there are 29 approved UV filters. Here in the United States, we have 16. And to break it down even further, looking at specifically UVA light, which is what ages our skin, in Europe, there are 9 UV filters for UVA light. Here in the United States, we only have 4.
So how does that translate to actual protection when we talk about if you're putting on sunscreen that you bought in America versus putting it on in other parts of the world?
So in the United States, sunscreen is regulated as an over-the-counter drug, and that's been happening since 1978. When you look at Europe, sunscreens are regulated as cosmetics there. They do not require human clinical data in order to get approved. However, their standards for UVA filter approval is more robust than what we have here in the United States. There is a suggestion that the FDA is gonna change the UVA approval standards here in the United States, which will bring up the parity level to be equivalent as to what is now, you know, normal process in Europe. So we're all kind of holding our breath, waiting for the FDA to make these types of changes.
And I think to the average person, when you hear extensive regulation to make sure that these substances that we're putting on our skin are safe, you think that's a good thing. But why is it that it seems like, from what you're saying, these other markets have found a better balance between safe ingredients and the best products for skin protection?
So it's interesting. Europe does not require human data in order for their filters to be approved. But in the studies that have come out since their filters have hit the market, there's very little data to suggest that it's in any type of way endangering the consumer there. There's very little dermal absorption, skin allergy reactions, irritant reactions. So the less regulation there in Europe has given them more options. But again, it hasn't come with any significant data to suggest that that's putting the consumer there in any type of harm. There's an exciting European filter, it's called Triasorb B, that covers into visible light, specifically blue light. We're learning more and more every day about how blue light ages the skin, affects melasma, rosacea, other dermatologic issues. So yes, it'll protect you against, you know, skin cancer and all of that, but these bells and whistles, the new technology, the savvier filters that are coming out in Europe, I'd love to see those start to now come to fruition on the American manufacturing side as well.
Bottom line, if you're putting on American sunscreen, what is your risk compared to somebody who's putting on sunscreen from a different market? And also, what should people who only have access to the American sunscreen market be doing to help protect themselves to the fullest extent?
Let's be clear, you're safe in using American products. It's not as though your skin is at any additional risk. I just want to be very clear about that. Everyone should be using sunscreen 365 days a year. You want to make sure that you're applying it on everything that's exposed. You want to make sure you're reapplying it every 2 hours. Ideally, you're using an SPF level that's between a 30 and a 50. Try to avoid high intensity sun exposure between 10 a.m. and 2 p.m. Wearing a wide-brimmed hat and clothing with UPF protection that covers exposed areas. These are all additional modifiable behaviors we can all take on. Skin cancer is the most common type of cancer here in the United States. You want to be making all of these good choices when you're outdoors as we come from summer and go into the fall as well.
Dr. Rita Linkner, board-certified dermatologist, thank you so much for breaking this down for us.
Thank you so much for having me, Allie.
Now online, a look at what we know about the 18 people indicted in Georgia, along with former President Donald Trump. All that and more is on our website, pbs.org/newshour. And that is PBS News Weekend for this Sunday. On Monday, Lonnie Bunch, the head of the Smithsonian, and NAACP Legal Defense Fund President Janae Nelson discussed the 60th anniversary of the March on Washington. I'm John Yang. For all of my colleagues, thanks for joining us. Have a good week.